Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Good evening, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm not bad. How are you?
Yeah, good.
You don't look like shit today.
Sorry?
You don't look like shit today.
No, neither do you, actually. You look well rested, and I commented earlier how good your camera's looking.
Yeah, it's a first for both of us, right? To be, not a first, but for at least for a while. How was my Father's Day? It was good. It was really good. We watched Superman.
Yep.
Obviously. And what else did we do? We did some plaster painting, and we did something else, and I can't remember what it was. But it was nice overall.
Yeah.
How was yours?
It was similar. We went out for breakfast in the morning, had a very chilled day. Didn't watch Superman, but
missing out.
No. Well, we caught up on the Formula One from the week before, watched the bit of the football, and I was building Lego that I got for Father's Day. So,
oh, nice. What did you get?
Formula One car.
Nice.
Another one to add to the collection that's up on the wall.
Ah, yes, I see. Which one? The is that a Batmobile next to it?
It is.
Oh, cool. Very nice.
Yeah. So it's not up there yet. It's still getting built.
Right. It's not finished yet. That's the other thing that I did was I had a bit of time to myself in the morning.
Yep.
And I had a call with Luke, with Cookie.
Oh, yeah.
And we spent a bit of time working on a little project we're working on the side.
Oh, God. You got time for side projects?
Because it was Father's Day, I was allowed a couple of hours to have a call to do that.
Gosh. We were just talking. Just talking before we hit record about how busy we both are and how much is on our own individual backlogs as well as our collective backlogs.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. Tomorrow is Are You Okay Day. I don't know if you were aware.
I am aware, yeah. In fact, I'll be heading into the office tomorrow and we're a few of us getting together for coffee and there's some of us going for lunch, which I won't be able to attend because I've got a client meeting, lunchtime meeting. They have offered to buy me lunch, so there's that.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. In fact, like it's bizarre. My meeting with them is at 1:00. They've got lunch at 12:00. So it's this client has got like a strategic offsite retreat, right?
Yep.
And they've asked me to come in and present something. They're having lunch at 12:00 and then I'm presenting at 1:00, but they've asked me to be there at 12:00 so that I can listen to their conversations to pick up context.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Look, there is a segue there that I want to jump into, but I think what we do need to quickly just cover off too is the episode we recorded last week.
Ah, yes.
That I'm in the process of just editing, cutting down, and getting that ready to release. So we were discussing the NPM supply chain attack.
Yes, that's right.
That was it Cookie that found that?
No.
So we were discussing that NPM supply chain attack. And then lo and behold, you sent me a message. Was it yesterday or was it this morning?
I think it was the day before, actually. So what is it today? Wednesday? I think it was Monday.
No, it was yesterday morning, my phone says.
You're right. It was yesterday morning. Wow. Yeah. Oh, this week has been a blur.
Yep. So yesterday morning, there was another NPM supply chain attack.
Yeah.
Except this one was a little bit more significant, a little bit larger.
Yeah.
And rather than using a cutting edge AI based type of injection attack, this one went to good old social engineering and phishing tactics.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah.
So
yeah, it was, I mean, look, I have to say, so let's explain a little bit about what happened, right? So this was an NPM. It was an NPM supply chain attack, but what actually happened was it was a repo that was compromised. So it was.
Was
I'm
it one?
To find the name of the.
I think it was a few, wasn't it?
Well, sorry. So it wasn't a repo. It was actually it was an NPM published token, right?
Yep.
So what happened was this guy. I'm trying to remember. So it was Josh, and I'm trying to remember the name of this org and what the packages are that they manage. Because, like, you know, I'm not a huge NPM user. So.
No.
Anyway, what they did was they sent him this email asking him to reassert his MFA because it had been a while.
Yep.
Now, this is probably the best crafted phishing email I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It is very, very good. And, you know, he does sort of say, you know, mea culpa. He puts his hands up and he says, yep, you know, I was pwned, he says specifically. Yep. And, you know, like I can kind of see why. So they registered the domain npmjs.help and mm-hmm. they sent the email from support at npmjs.help. The email yep. is very legit looking. Obviously, the headers would have been correct as per the domain. The thing is, though, you know, obviously there are some red flags here, right? The first one being, don't do that. Like, don't click links in emails and hand over yep. credentials.
Yep.
Right. The other thing is that if you'd have looked at the Whois record, you would have seen that domain, npmjs.help, had only been registered 2 days prior.
Yeah, but, I mean, are you checking the Whois domain from every email that comes in?
If I it is a habit that I have, so I do quite regularly check Whois records for like not for every email. Like if I've got an email and I 100% know it's legit, but often, yeah, if I have any kind of suspicion about an email, I check the Whois record. You know, I hover over links to, mm-hmm. to, you know, see what they're going to say. Sometimes yep. I'll open them in a sandbox. Yeah, I'm very cautious with this stuff. Yeah.
Hmm. And
I mean, I also, the other thing I do is check headers.
Yep.
As in check the message headers. So yes, look, I am in the habit of doing all that kind of stuff. Yes. But I get it. Not everyone is. And, you know, absolutely, as he says, you know, they had been swamped. He had been absolutely swamped. And, you know, it was a very legit looking email. He was so overwhelmed with so many things. He just thought, I really just need to just get this done. So he just got it done. That was the compromise.
So to cut a long story short, the significance of this supply chain attack, right? The numbers I was seeing were the packages that got compromised were on the order of, what was it, about 2 billion downloads a week.
Yeah.
Collectively.
Yeah.
Right. That's absolutely not insignificant.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I had the same thought. And yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this and I was crunching the numbers in my head a little bit. And I was thinking, so of that, there'll be tie kickers, there'll be CICD builds, tests, all sorts, right? But 2 billion is still a big number. And like 1% of 1% of 2 billion
mm-hmm.
is still a very big number.
Yep, absolutely.
So we're still talking.
Week.
Yeah. So we're still talking conservatively / optimistically, depending on which way you want to look at it, but realistically, probabilistically, millions of deployments of this compromised package to production.
It was more than one package.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
Millions of compromised.
That's what I meant. Is like millions of deployments of this malware.
Yeah. Yep.
And you know what else like strikes me about this was that, think about it, right? It's very clever as well. So we should probably explain a little bit about the malware. Like basically it's a crypto wallet stealer.
Yep.
In a nutshell, but a very clever one and a very sophisticated one. Like it did a lot of things to look legit and it did a lot of things to cover its tracks. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe won't go into too much detail, but that's what it did. But it didn't steal crypto wallets from the people it compromised, right? Mm-hmm. So if you've got a crypto wallet and you visited a website or used an app that had been compromised, you're screwed. And this is where it's so egregious, right? Is like, and we kind of said the same thing about the Singularity one, right? Which is that you needn't even necessarily be someone that has used this tool.
Mm.
And you needn't necessarily even be someone that has done the wrong thing here, right? Because you weren't the one that was compromised, they were.
Yeah.
But somehow you're the victim. Not only that, you know, like I said, last time, you don't even have to be an organization that's using this tool. You could have someone that works for you that has access to your repo that also uses it on another project, and that could have compromised your credentials.
Yeah.
And this one is kind of even worse. Like, you could have absolutely nothing to do with this, visit a website and have all of your crypto money stolen. Now, granted, I have particular feelings about the whole crypto situation. And on the one hand, I'm kind of a little bit unsympathetic to it. But on the other hand, I'm not entirely unsympathetic to it.
Yeah.
So yeah. Anyway, yes, it's a scary world. And, you know, again, you mentioned that this wasn't a sophisticated AI. This is good old social engineering. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if that npmjs.help website and email and this malware had been vibe coded.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. I think, yeah, I mean, it's wouldn't be hard to spin up a website that looks legit.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be functional, right? Just needs to look legit.
You know, the other thing as well to think about, you know how if you go on ChatGPT and you say, write me a virus, right?
Yep.
It says, no, sorry, I can't do that. I can't do that, Dave. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Those controls are not in the large language model. They're in ChatGPT.
Yep.
And these models are freely available.
Yep.
And if you've got even a modest GPU or, you know, an Apple, whatever processor, you can run these models locally without any of those safeguards or controls.
Absolutely.
So it's very easy for you to pull one of these down and get it to do evil things. And in fact, to be honest, it's not trivial to social engineer ChatGPT, but it's also not that hard.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you say to ChatGPT, I'm testing my SIEM, right? Or I'm testing my intruder detection system, and I need to write a script that does XYZ because I want to see if my system picks it up. Help me generate the script. It's going to do it.
Yep. Yeah.
If you're that specific.
No, that's it. It's technology is moving far more rapidly, and I don't know, like society, are we keeping up?
I was going to say, I was going to ask if I've mentioned this before, but I mentioned it on the episode with Yuli and that book, Cat's Cradle.
Yep.
It all just reminds me of that.
Yep.
I don't think you've read it.
No.
Yeah.
Is it going to become more frequent? I guess time will tell. I think like the security tools are catching up, but there's going to be a lag time. And I think the problem is that with technology moving forward so rapidly, like the safeguards need to move just as rapidly, but they're not.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I guess that's part of the problem as well, right? Which is that the way to do that is to have red teaming and adversarial agents, right? And, you know, just have teams of agents that don't have those safeguards and controls in place and get them to come up with stuff. And then, you know, so Yuli's mentioned this before as well, which is a GAN, which is it generative adversarial network, something adversarial network. And that's how you do it, is you basically just get these things to compete with each other so that you're kind of preparing various different forms of defense. But there's a big risk with that as well, because like, isn't that how we get Skynet?
Pretty much. So I'm trying really hard to do some mental gymnastics here I'm trying really hard to do some mental gymnastics, working on my agility, to figure out how we can pivot across to one of the topics we wanted to talk about today.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. But just to cap that off, it is all moving at a fast pace, and you know we can't keep up, and we're going to have to be incredibly agile to be able to retain the kind of momentum that we need.
And that's it. And the topic that you wanted to talk about tonight sort of focuses in on that word agile,
right?
And the, I guess, the definition, what does agility, what does agile actually mean?
Yeah.
And obviously there's the dictionary definition.
Yeah.
Then there's the XP definition.
Yeah.
And then there's the project management definition.
Yeah.
And they're similar, but they all sort of differ, right? They do have their own subtle differences.
Yeah.
And I think
there's another way to look at this then.
Yeah.
I can tell you what it's not.
What's that?
And well, I mean, I can give you a few examples of what it's not, right? And this is kind of what prompted me to want to talk about this, because I've had some interesting conversations recently with various people, and it's become clear to me that people have different understandings of what agile means, as you've very eloquently just articulated, right? Mm-hmm. It means different things to different people. But when something means different things to different people, sometimes that can mean that some people think it can mean whatever they want it to mean.
So
and that's not really fair.
They use a bit of agility to define the word agile.
That's right. That's right. Yep. So to give you an example, and I've got to be very careful what I say, but to give you a real world example, I was having a conversation with someone quite recently, and it became clear from the conversation with this person that their expectation was for the team to be able to ramp up and down on demand on any given day, to be able to, so this is an audio recording, so people can't see the kind of head twitch that Liam just did when I said that. I'm probably going to extract that out of the recording and make a GIF of it. Anyway, seriously, this is what this person thought. Yep. And also thought that, and it was so interesting because obviously we had the conversation recently about deep focus, right?
Yep.
And it was so interesting to hear this person say, well, I'm part-time on this project and I'm part-time on many different projects. I have to manage my time. And that means that I do a little bit here, a little bit there, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I had to explain very politely to that person that, well, if you're a project manager, or in fact, if you are someone whose job it is to divide your attention, and if you're someone whose job it is to do things that are task-based, that works for you. Yep. But when you're employed, and by the way, literally I am, this is what I'm engaged on this project for. When you're engaged on this project specifically to do tech spikes and specifically to be two sprints ahead of the rest of the team to unblock them,
yep,
and figure out things, no, that's not how it works. You need to like turn your phone off and get into deep, deep focus. So, yep. So there's one example of what agility isn't.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that it isn't.
Yeah, yeah, keep going.
And we've said this before, right? The other thing that it isn't is having no plan at all.
Yep. And that was my sort of tongue-in-cheek stab at the project management definition.
Yeah.
Right. I've been on teams before where they've used the term, or they've used the idea of being agile basically to say we're not doing any form of planning at all.
Yeah, and that's not what it means. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, ironically, those people are the same ones that don't know what to do with themselves when they're not doing waterfall anymore,
yeah,
which is all about planning everything up front. And really, you know, like this is the thing is, if you think about agile really, and you compare agile to waterfall, you kind of do exactly the same exercise at first, which is you figure out what all the parts are to build your product. Yeah. The difference is with waterfall, you say up front, this is exactly when we're going to do them. Whereas with agile, you put them all in a big bucket and you say what makes sense to do first.
Yeah.
And you do that. And then you plan the next bit. You plan one bit at a time. And obviously the major benefit of that is that it's much easier to change your plan if you need to. Right. As opposed to something that is planned and locked in, set in stone for 2 years ahead.
Yeah.
And this ties into actually something else that we've touched on, not on the episodes, but we've touched on the idea of talking about, which is about innovation and governance and whether they're mutually exclusive. And it kind of ties into this as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let's save that discussion for another time, I think. But yeah, I mean, you know, that's it really. Like that's really the fundamental difference.
And
but the other thing then is that, you know, just to cap off what this person was saying is that one thing that you don't do is change what you're doing mid sprint.
Yeah. Can I think there's a point that I just want to raise there though, is that conflating Scrum and sprints with Agile.
You're right. I am conflating right. them.
And a lot of, and I think that's a common misconception, right? That a lot of people, they bundle Scrum and Agile and assume that they're the same thing.
Yeah, you're right. That's true. Yeah.
But they're not. They are mutually exclusive.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Sorry, they're not mutually exclusive. You can have one without the other.
Yes.
Sorry, I just wanted to mention that because...
Well, you can't have Scrum without Agile.
Sorry, you can't have Scrum without Agile.
But you can have Agile without Scrum.
Yeah.
Scrum is an Agile methodology.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yep. Yep, yep. But the other thing I wanted to come back to, too, was back to the original Agile manifesto, right?
Yeah.
And at no point do they say, we do not have a plan.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Right? It's, and for anyone that hasn't seen it, the Agile manifesto basically says, I've got it in front of me now, individuals and interactions over process and tools. Working software over comprehensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, and responding to change over following a plan. And that is, while there is value in the items on the right, we value items on the left more.
Yeah.
So responding to change over following a plan. They're not saying following a plan doesn't exist and it's not worth it. They're just saying you can have your plan, but be ready to adapt.
Yeah. And like, and just to kind of borrow a phrase from you, having a plan, following a plan and responding to change are not mutually exclusive.
Yep.
And as I have said ad nauseum on this podcast before, I'm always very fond of saying that if you fail to plan, you plan to fail.
Yeah.
But equally, no plan survives contact with the enemy.
Absolutely.
And again, those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Yep, agree with that 100%. And so I think one thing, when you mentioned this interaction you had recently, made me wonder, I wonder if there's a tool in our toolbox that we could
use. There was a tool in that conversation.
No need to put yourself down like that. I wonder if there's a tool in our toolbox that we can use to actually help mitigate these conflicts and these conflicts in language.
Some kind of dictionary, do you think?
Yeah, just something that a language that everyone uses, you know, something that's ubiquitous around the organization.
Yeah. Something that gives you context.
Yeah. But like, maybe it is one of those things that as a team, and maybe this person's in your team, maybe they're not, maybe they're in your organization, maybe they're not, but thinking sort of as a team or as a project or even as an organization to come up with your agreed upon definition of the term.
Hmm.
To make sure that everyone, it might be exactly as aligned to the Agile Manifesto. It might be different. It might be suited to your organization. But it's one that when everyone uses the term Agile, they know what you mean.
Yeah.
And they know what the expectations are. Now, I think further to that, it's funny, earlier this year, we, you know, at work at the moment, having a conversation with someone, and it just turned to them asking, what's something in your everyday life that your work life has had an unexpected impact on, or something similar to that? And I was thinking about it. And to me, the one thing that really stood out to me was my use, or my, what's the word? Unofficial use. And I've just done it there, exactly right there. My unofficial use of the ubiquitous dictionary.
Right.
I make sure that I'm quite deliberate in what I'm saying and the terms that I'm using. And if I use the term agile, I'm quite deliberate about that because I know what my definition is. But at the same time, if I feel that there is a difference, like, we need to make sure that we're all on the same page. So I'm not going to turn around to someone and say, hey, let's write a ubiquitous dictionary about this conversation we're going to have. But like, it's just, let's make sure that the terms we're using, or being aware that the terms we're using can be misinterpreted in different contexts.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what the ubiquitous dictionary is there to resolve. When I'm in one context, make sure that the terms that I'm using fit that context.
And yeah, absolutely.
One discussion, like very similar discussion I had last week, right? The team I'm working with, and, you know, there's the side of the business that I'm working with at the moment, you know, they're not overly from the technical side of things, but we're working with a technical department. And the term tech debt has been thrown around quite a lot. And I know we've spoken about it in the past, but it's, again, it's one of those terms that at a high level, people understand what it means.
Yeah.
But until you actually explain it to people and taking that step back and taking the time to explain it to them and the nuances of what it actually means and the concepts that there is good debt, there's bad debt, there's, there's reckless and... what's the quadrant? I can't remember now off the top of my head.
Prudent, reckless, prudent. Accidental, intentional.
Exactly, right. So there's, you know, intentional, reckless obviously is not a good type of debt. Right, being able to break it down and making sure that in that team now, when we use the term tech debt, everyone's on the same page.
Mm.
We're not making assumptions about, okay, well, what does that mean? Is it just something that the tech team have come up with just to say, we're not going to do it your way because we've already got too much tech debt? Right? When it's a non-tech person that you're talking to, that they don't understand what the nuances of that term mean, it starts to lose its value and its impact.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and I feel the same with Agile, right? Especially in the software space, especially because it is such a, I mean, it's a common term in the English language.
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
And
from a business perspective, from a non-technical stakeholder perspective, it's an attractive term because, again, like sort of going back to this innovation and governance thing, but businesses want to be agile. Many, many businesses want to be agile, right? Because it means that, well, I mean, the key part of that is responding to change.
Yep.
So if you are threatened by a competitor or a change in the market, if there's a risk, if there's an opportunity, you don't want to miss out on that opportunity. You don't want to be at risk from that threat any more than necessary in both of those cases, right? So an agile business is able to quickly adapt and respond to that change and capitalize on those opportunities and protect itself from those risks.
Mm-hmm.
When you say to someone who's a non-technical stakeholder, who's a non-project or product-oriented stakeholder, we're using an agile methodology, it gives them comfort because that, to them, in their mind, because as you said, it's a word. It's a word in the English language. This isn't a technical term. And it means something. And it paints a picture in their mind of agile and methodology. So that says it gives us the comfort that we are able to respond to change. It gives us the comfort that it is subject to governance. It's not having a plan, right? And not having governance. So I think that that's why it's something that many businesses latch onto, even without fully knowing what it means. And we see that across many things, not even just in tech, certainly in marketing.
Yeah.
But I just want to come back to something to just a slight tangent here, because I think it's really interesting what you're talking about ubiquitous language, and mm-hmm. even without having a ubiquitous language dictionary, but having an agreed definition of a term or a concept. It's the reason I say it's an interesting point is because it's actually a fundamental aspect of contract law. So in Australia, we have a core premise of contract law is this term consensus ad idem, which is Latin. It means literally a meeting of the minds. Mm. And so much of Australian contract law comes down to this. And a lot of contractual disputes are literally about this, right? It means that there was not a shared understanding of what a term in a contract meant.
Yep, which is why contracts have all the terms explicitly spelt out. When we say you, we mean ABC. When we say us, we mean, and they list it all out. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Although they are very bad at other things, but, you know, that's a whole other thing entirely. And it does, there's another subject I've been wanting to talk to you about for a while, which is codifying intent. But again, let's have that conversation another time.
Codifying intent.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm trying to get my head around what that actually means, because, you know, as we've just discussed, right, they're both two words within the English language, but I could probably come up with my own definition of what you're discussing or what you want to discuss.
This will be an interesting exercise.
Which could differ to what you actually want, the intent of what you want to cover.
Well, this will be an interesting exercise. Why don't you tell me what you think it means?
So today I came across... GitHub have released their new spec-driven development, right?
Yeah.
The spec-driven or co-pilot. And to me, that those two, it sounds like that aligns with very similar to what you're thinking or what you're talking about there with codifying intent.
It is right? very similar.
I want to codify my specs of what I want the application to do or what I want the project to do and provide that in a codified way. So that an agent of some sort, be that human or artificial intelligence, can actually then take that spec and do what needs to be done.
Yes, that's very, very close to my intent. I'll come back to just a slight tangent about this spec kit, because I've been looking at it for a few days as well, and I think it looks very cool. I fell over at the first hurdle. Run this, UVX dash dash blah, 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 blah.
I did the same, and I'm like, hang on, what the hell is UVX?
Yeah. Yeah, same thing. Yeah, exactly. And then I went down that rabbit hole a little bit, and then I thought, I'm not installing all this crap. So I parked that one. But I am very interested in it because, yes, that is very, very close to what I meant. And I mean, it's effectively almost exactly what I meant, with one additional caveat, which is that when you codify your intent, you can test it. And what I mean by that is you can put together, once you've codified your intent, you can put together scenarios, run them through the interpreter, and validate whether or not the intent is correctly codified.
Yep. And I think regardless of if we're going down the path that you're talking about, codifying intent. Oh, now we're going... This is way off topic.
Yeah.
I was going to say this episode's becoming quite agile itself. But just... If you're codifying intent or if you're writing out your specs in the spec kit, whatever it is, what I really like about all this is you start with the documentation side of things, right? So you're
working
starting
software over complex documentation.
Sorry?
Working software over complex documentation.
Yeah, but that's just it, right? Documentation always takes a back seat.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm 100% guilty of that myself. But if you've got your intent covered up front, if you've got the specs written out, you're forced to do it early. And then that's what's based on, then that's what generates the actual project and the product that follows behind.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing is, you know, this is why Spec Kit exists, because I saw a post on LinkedIn earlier this week, and it was this guy saying something along the lines of, if vibe coding has taught us anything, it's not that, you know, people need to be able to have access to tools so they don't need to code. Being able to code was never the problem. You know, people need to be able to define requirements, and that's
always been the problem.
Yeah, and that's the same problem. And that's why SpecKit exists. I think it's brilliant. I'm really keen to play with it if I can figure out what UVX is. But yeah, I mean, this is exactly what I'm talking about, really. And maybe this is, in fact, the core topic, really, because we're talking about different understandings of what terms mean. So we started off talking about agility, and now we're talking about other things. But fundamentally, the issue is the same, is that when people have different understandings of what a term means or what a concept means, that's where problems arise. And you know what? I'll have to look this up, because there is a statistic for this, I'm sure. But something about failed marriages, like the overwhelming majority of failed marriages occur due to communication breakdowns. And I may be making that up, so I'll have to check. But yeah, and this is why I'm really interested in this topic of codifying intent. There is something else that we've also said we're going to talk about another time, which is this innovation versus governance thing and innovation versus compliance. Mm-hmm. But something that I've always found really interesting, so talking about Australian law again, so we mentioned the contract law, but the other one is the Australian Privacy Act.
Yep.
Have you ever looked at it?
Not in great depth, no, but it's something that I have had to look over relatively recently.
Yeah. So you're aware of how it's structured.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if you look at pretty much any other piece of legislation, it's written like a contract, like we just described, right? It's made up of sections and clauses. It's made of, you know, it's got definitions and so on and so forth. Whereas if you look at the Australian Privacy Act, that it's not that at all. It's made up of the 13 Australian privacy principles. And it is by definition what's called principles-based law.
Yeah.
And I find it really interesting because it's all about intent. Like it's not that it's non-prescriptive, but for a piece of legislation, it is incredibly non-prescriptive. It is very descriptive. And it, as I said, it's principles-based. It's based on these 13 privacy principles that express intent rather than, what's the word I'm looking for, that's the opposite to intent. So if they're descriptive, what's the prescriptive thing? I'm struggling to find the word. Irrespective, as I said, they're principles-based, and you know, they express intent rather than, this is specifically you must do this, that, and the other, or this is the rule. It's like, it's not the rule, it's the principle. And something that I think is also really interesting about this, and again, going back to the very first topic we were talking about this evening, about keeping up with changes in security, this isn't new. Like, obviously, we're seeing a whole bunch of things happening now because of AI, but we were having these conversations 10, 15 years ago.
Mm.
We were having these conversations about how do we, as an organization, have a security policy that is worth the paper it's printed on when everything changes so quickly. And, you know, the threat landscape is adapting and evolving so quickly. Like, how can we have these policies and you know, be able to enforce them and enact them and keep ourselves safe, protect our crown jewels, our data, and, you know, our customers and everything else? How can we comply with these privacy principles? You know, by having these policies. Policies are by definition rigid. They're like the waterfall of governance itself, right? You know, to change a policy requires a committee and sign off and blah, 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 right? So even 10, 15 years ago, when these were the conversations we were having around this stuff, there was already a trend among certain organizations towards saying, let's not have a security policy. It's not worth it. It's too hard. It doesn't give us what we need. It restricts us from actually being able to do what we need to do. Mm-hmm. And what organizations were doing was pivoting into having a security strategy, because a strategy is not prescriptive. It expresses intent.
Yep.
So whereas a policy might have policy sections, and each section might have a policy statement, and each section might then be followed by details. And a security policy might say something very specific, like, really, really random ones here, but, you know, all user accounts must have MFA enforced.
Sure.
Okay, sure. All user accounts, all disks must be encrypted. All data must be encrypted at rest and in motion. That's you know, like, okay, cool, sure. And then there's, you know, there's, and then of course it's all handed over to ops with no budget to figure out how to do that in a way that doesn't disrupt the users, but that's a whole other thing. But let's take that MFA one, for example, right? If you have that in a policy, you have your policy that says, okay, we need to make sure everyone's got MFA enabled. Get a little bit of budget for organizational change management. You get a little bit of budget for investing in, I don't know where I got that from. It'd be a lot of budget, but you get a lot of budget for investing in Duo Authenticator, right? So you don't have to buy everyone the little RSA footballs or whatever, right?
Yep.
Or whatever. But the point is it's done. And once it's done, the organization then gains inertia against doing something different. And then the entirety security landscape changes, and having MFA isn't enough.
Yep.
Not to say you shouldn't have MFA, but it's not enough. Look at what happened to Josh.
Yep.
I'm talking about right at the start. So now, you know, you need, okay, so what do you need? Well, you need MFA, you need pass keys, you need probably gated approval workflows for all these kind of things that you need to be able to do without being restricted by policy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, by having your intent codified and your intent expressed in a strategy, you become more agile.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
I see what you did. But are you, you know, just, I guess, to play with the semantics there, are you being more adaptable or are you being more agile?
That's a good question. And we never did quite get to our consensus ad item about what we mean by agile. But for me, agile means fundamentally, look, it means a lot of things and there's a lot of different things of what it means and what it doesn't mean. But if you were to ask me what the core of agile is, what does it mean at its heart? What is the fundamental principle? It's responding to change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Which covers adaptability too.
Yeah.
Yep.
One might argue that the difference between adaptability and agility is that agility is doing it quickly.
No, I don't. So to me, adaptability is about changing the way you work.
Okay.
Agility would be more changing your course.
Yeah.
So one is changing the what and the other one is changing the how. So.
Yeah. Okay. I see.
But that's my interpretation. Right. And that's why I wanted to make that differentiation of the terms is that if you're telling me we're changing direction, we're changing what we're going after, that shows my agility.
Yeah.
But if you're going to change how, like the landscape we're in or how we're going to attack that goal or something in that landscape changes, then I need to adapt.
Yeah. So what about this scenario, right? Let's say you've got a backlog, a product backlog. You're about to launch your V1. Your current milestones say for V1 you're gonna include features A, B, C. In your next milestone you're gonna include D, E, F, so on and so forth. Your head of sales comes to you and says, we're gonna onboard our third customer, but they're only gonna sign if we have feature H.
Yeah.
So now you're gonna do feature H next instead of feature D.
But to me, that's agility because we're changing what our goal is, right? But if you then turn around to me and say, right, we are going from a cloud-based environment to on-prem, or we're going from a .NET application to a Rust application, that's the how. How are we going about doing it? How are we achieving that goal? Or more, maybe more like, or not likely, but an easier example to get your head around would be, I don't know, that Microsoft turn around and say, we're no longer supporting C#. We're going to drop it, right? So now you need to adapt. As an organization, you're going to need to adapt your tools and your way of working to pick up other tools to still achieve the same goal. And you might then go down the path of using Rust because C# no longer supported, right? That's your how. You're going to change because you have to. Well, maybe not have to, but there's been direction to say you need to change how you're working, the tools you're using. But the point you were making before with features, I mean, that's what we're that's our direction. That's what are we going for? What are we going after?
Yeah.
And that's why I make that differentiation that to me is, that's agility, yes.
Yeah. Yes. So we are agreed on that one.
Yeah, that part of it.
Yes.
But, you know, it's not a hill I'm going to die on, that there's the differentiation between adaptability and agility.
No, it's not a hill I would care to die on either. But, you know, nuance is important. Hence contract law existing. law existing.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine a world without lawyers?
Well, I mean, it goes one or two ways, doesn't it? I can tell you which way I think it'd go. Imagine if the Privacy Act and privacy law didn't exist.
Yeah. Well, imagine if they didn't have to.
Well, that's what I mean. That's the two different ways, right?
Yeah.
One, the anarchy that occurs when they don't exist, or two, the utopia that you're in when they don't have to exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unfortunately, we're in the middle ground.
That's right.
Fortunately or unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh, what was that? I'm sure it must have been a tweet. And this was probably somewhere deep into COVID or something. And someone tweeted something along the lines of, how did we end up in the timeline where we're in the post-apocalypse, but we still have to go to work?
Yeah, that's where we're at. So have we agreed upon a definition of agility or agile?
I don't know if we've agreed on a definition, but I think we have a meeting of the minds on conceptually what it means.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those things, like my example with the tech debt, is that I think it's our duty as consultants in that space, particularly in the software space, to make sure that the people that we're working with understand the language within our context.
Can I just say that I think it is our duty as human beings working with other human beings to do that?
It would make the whole business process a lot more efficient.
Yes. And again, depending on your perspective, that's either a good thing or a bad thing.
True. But no, I think it's one of those things that if we're all aware, and it's hard, right? And I've had people, colleagues in the past, ask me or comment that, you know, I'll take time to articulate and to explain what I mean. And that's just experience from being in the consulting space. And it's being experience in consulting with people from non-technical backgrounds and having to convey technical concepts and ideas to them in ways that they understand.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just being aware that, yes, a term like agile or tech debt may mean one thing to them, but it might be something different within our context, within our ecosystem, and we need to make sure that they understand what we mean when we say it.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because I'm the same. I like to explain things, as I've mentioned before, and in terms of my actual qualifications, that's what I'm qualified for.
More than I'm qualified for.
But, you know, again, talking about the post-COVID era, you know, one thing that I've really struggled with, you know, my go-to tool was back in the before times.
Go-to tool for what?
For these kinds of conversations, not the kinds that we're having now, but the kinds that we're describing with other stakeholders.
No, I don't know. The internet.
The whiteboard.
The whiteboard. I love a good physical whiteboard.
I love a good physical whiteboard. I have one right here. Yeah.
And I mean, Miro's a decent alternative when you cannot get into a room and pick up a texter and draw on the wall.
Yeah.
But to be able to go up to a wall and just scribble out what you need to, wipe it out, start again, I think there's no comparable alternative.
No substitute.
No substitute, no.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. It's, you know, I've had to get better at describing things and explaining things without it, but I miss it. And yeah, you're right. Not just for the explanatory power that comes with it, but for the collaborative power.
And the brainstorming.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it's not a whiteboard, it's a pen and paper.
Yeah. Something that I've really been wanting to do, and it frustrates me that I can't. And part of it is that other people have to have similar tools, but I've got quite a nice tablet with a stylus. Yep. I'd love to be able to just join a Teams call with that and just whiteboard on it. I don't know why I can't.
Teams do have a whiteboard plugin, don't they?
Yeah, I've just never been able to make it work that way.
Yeah. Well, but like you said, you know, it would be handy if other people have one.
It would, yeah. 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 Why doesn't everyone have one?
I think I'm trying to think of a really smart-ass answer because I think it's quite obvious, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what else is a really good tool for that as well is VR. Why doesn't everyone have VR?
Is VR a good tool for that?
It's pretty good, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
The collaboration.
Yeah. There was a Teams VR plugin at one point where you could do like a virtual meeting space and do collaborative whiteboarding in VR. It was really good, actually. Hmm. And there are various other tools that let you do it. But yeah, it's good. I mean, basically, you can have a whiteboard of equivalent of a mirror, I guess. You've got an infinite canvas and you can change the size of it and you can move it around and look at different bits and you can draw on it with your finger or with a pen or whatever.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll need to invest in one.
Maybe you will. In fact, rumor has it, this is way off topic, but rumors literally this week are that the long awaited Valve new headset is you know, on the way soon. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. I won't nerd out on that one.
Topic.
You already gave me my VR episode.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's staying off topic. When we were in New Zealand recently, my son and I did one of those VR escape rooms.
Oh, yeah.
It was good fun.
Yeah? Oh, good.
Yeah. I don't know what headset. I can't remember what headsets they used, but it was just, yeah, just a good little problem-solving challenge for the two of us.
Yeah. Did he enjoy it?
He did. He really, really enjoyed it. Keeps talking about it all the time.
Yeah, cool.
And there I was looking at the headsets trying to work out, and I wonder how much one of these would cost me. Or two.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's take this one offline, but maybe we'll do a virtual beer-driven devs episode. We could do a whole episode in VR.
That gives me an excuse to go out and buy one.
Yeah.
Unless someone wants to sponsor me one. No, but look, I mean, if there's interest, if anyone wants to ping us on LinkedIn and reply to some comments and let us know if they're interested in that, I think that'd be pretty awesome.
That would be pretty cool.
Do you know what would be even better?
Meeting up in person and going to the pub for a beer.
An actual reality one.
Yeah, an actual reality.
Yeah, an AR, actual reality. But look, I think that's something you and I have spoken about in the past.
Yeah.
Just doing an unofficial catch-up at a pub somewhere.
Yeah, I'm keen. We should do it.
Gosh. So many things to do. And then there's, you know what, actually just brainstorming right now, we should actually set aside the night before AdaConf if you're keen. I know you've got a talk on, but if you're keen, that might be worthwhile. Seeing if there's anyone around that wants to meet up. Or the speaker's doing a meetup.
I don't know. I haven't heard anything. But the night of AdaConf would be better because, as you said, I've got a talk.
Well, let's...
I remember when I did NDC, which was February last year, and the number of people just... Maybe I shouldn't say this because it's a professionalism thing, but there was a lot of heavy drinking going on, and there was people drinking heavily and then doing talks the next day. I could not do that. And in fact, you may or may not remember, but...
speakers at NDC. Sorry? There are a lot of professional experienced speakers at NDC.
That's true, yeah. As I say, I don't know if you recall, but I specifically... held back because I think my talk was because I had the did I have the Tuesday Wednesday I had the workshop or the Monday Tuesday I had the workshop and then the Wednesday Thursday Friday were the talks and my talk was on the Thursday, so I didn't have a drink all week until Thursday night until my talk was out the way. But then with that said, I was still writing my talk like Thursday morning, so
yeah, you always do. I think organizing a few catch-ups, maybe one in Melbourne night of AdaConf, maybe one sometime in Sydney in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
We'd be super keen to hear from anyone out there that would like to join us.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. I'm definitely keen.
Yeah.
It's probably not going to be within the next, well, we'll see. We'll see when we can do it. Maybe around that same time. I don't know. We can figure it out. Not in the next couple of weeks because I've got some things coming up. We have got a first birthday party for Sadie next weekend.
Oh. Wow. Gosh, that's gone so quick.
I know. Yeah. And I've got some news, actually, that's very, very tangentially related to that. I've got a brew on.
You got a brew?
I'll tell you. Yeah, it's been a while. I've got a brew on. In fact, I've got two. I've got a lager and a pale ale sitting there behind the bar in their fermenters right now. And they've been going for like nearly 3 weeks now, So
actually, I should get one on maybe this week. I need to look at my calendar because it's going to start getting warm soon.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's why, because it's been too cold. And I've, you know, the lager has actually been doing really well.
Yeah.
Because it's the perfect temperature for them. Like, it's not too cold anymore, like it was over the winter.
Yeah. What's it down to, about 12, 15?
Overnight, it's a bit, I think it may have been getting a bit lower than that. It's about that now.
Oh, no. I mean the fermenter. What's it fermenting at?
Oh, it's currently sitting around 18 to 20, but that's the warmth being generated by the yeast, not the ambient temperature.
Right.
The other one, the ale, is ironically sitting a bit cooler than that because it's not warm enough to wake the yeast up. So it is. It is fermenting. It's just not. You know, it's fermenting much more slowly.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. Yeah, I got a brew on. And the other thing is that I mentioned to you is you might be up here to sample some of that in a few weeks.
Yeah. That's it. 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years.
Is it? Can we send return to sender yet?
It's too late for that.
Too late.
Like I tell you, like the first, what was it? It was 6 years, I guess, of living here before I became a citizen. Oh, for anyone, yeah. So sorry. Context: having a bit of a barbecue to celebrate 10 years of Australian citizenship, which will be next month.
So just in order for clarity, is that an open invite to everyone, or is you just telling people?
I'm just telling people.
Okay.
But yeah. So the first 6 years that I was here, it was a mad scramble to like get that PR, get the permanent residence, and then from there to get the citizen. It's like even when I got the permanent residence,
hey, you know, it still works. It could be a pull request.
Go on.
Oh, just you're requesting to be pulled across to here.
I'm lost.
The PR to come into Australia.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, yeah, sorry. Yeah, PR it's is a permanent pull residence. Yeah, permanent residence. So before that, I had like a visa that I had to have renewed frequently. And, you know, anytime there's this fear that it might not get renewed, and then finally I get the permanent residence. And then there's this fear that like, well, I'm not a citizen. Like at any time that could, you know, who knows what could happen politically, or you never know. So, yeah, once I got that citizenship, I felt a lot more relaxed. And that's been 10 years.
Oh, wow. 10 years. Sorry, 10 years as a citizen or 10 years since you first came here?
10 years as a citizen, yep. 16 years since I came out.
Yeah, okay. Awesome.
Such a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, what happens?
Yeah, it does. And speaking of time going quickly, I think it is time to call last orders on this conversation. Trying that one as an alternative to On That Bombshell. How did it land?
Calling last orders, yeah.
Yeah.
Don't mind it. Last drinks. Yeah.
Yeah. See how it goes.
Look, you can even tie that into the end. Instead of that's it for this episode, you change it to that's last drinks for this episode.
Yeah. Well, we can try that if you want. See,
look,
how we go.
Look, we're quite agile around here.
That's right. Yeah. We're adaptable.
That's it.
It's an ongoing experiment.
Oh, look, that's life, isn't it?
Yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking.
That's right.
Consensus ad item on that one.
Yep. Okay. Well, I think that's last drinks for this episode, the Beer Driven Devs Mart. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
What the hell? And I was just like, looking at this news, and I was like, another breach? Like, yeah. NPM, come on, another breach? It's like a week later.